Meeting will come to order. I want to apologize. We're doing our appropriation bill, and probably 25 or 30 minutes ago, they called me and said that we were going to have votes within 5 minutes. So I thought, well, that's great. Well, I'll run over and vote and get that done before we start. But it's the rule, the House has rules, and the rule is such that basically anybody that shows up, you know, with an amendment can do it. And so they appear to keep showing up when they're not supposed to. So I think what we'd like to do is go ahead. Ms. Herseth is on the way. So I'm going to go ahead and do my opening statement, and then we'll kind of go from there. But, again, we expect votes just at any second. And so, as you all know, that's just something that we have to deal with. So I wish I had the ability to call over and tell the leadership that we're busy over here, not to vote till we get done. But I'm not in that situation. Today, we are here to receive testimony on the Veterans Transition Assistance and Disabled Transition Assistance Program, usually referred to as TAP and DTAP. TAP and DTAP are designed to smooth the transition of service members back to civilian life. I believe this is an absolutely vital program, especially in light of the conflict in the Middle East. It's probably fair to say that despite all the modern media that service members are exposed to, military life is somewhat isolated from mainstream society. That's not a criticism on my part. Rather, it's important to recognize that whether a service member is leaving after initial enlistment or a career, they will face a society much different from the military. Working relationships are different. Pay and benefit systems are different. There is no mutual bond of duty and sacrifice. Therefore, it is not unreasonable that we ask commanding officers to make service members available for 3 or 4 days out of enlistment or a career to begin the transition process. Along those lines, I want to state my strong opposition to the draft memorandum of understanding being circulated that would limit TAP and DTAP to 2 days. I've seen the TAP and DTAP curriculum, and I don't think there's any way that a TAP staff can present that amount of information in 2 days and expect it to be retained by the participants. Even the 4-day version I observed at Navy Norfolk was rapid fire, and if you didn't pay attention, you'd miss some valuable information. By the way, I want to say brave Zulu to the TAP staff in Norfolk. They put out about 10,000 departing service members through TAP every year, and of those 10,000, approximately one-third avail themselves of the Benefits Delivery at Discharge, or BDD, program. If any base wants to see how it's done right, go to Norfolk. I have a special concern about how we are demobilizing members of the Guard and Reserves. I know some units schedule a post-mobilization drill period to present TAP sessions. This sounds like a good approach, and I hope that best practice can be applied nationally. Until now, we have only looked at transition as the process of leaving the military. As far as the Guard and Reserves are concerned, transition should also be used to describe the process of being called up to active duty. That process is a transition potentially more stressful given the high percentage of the Guard and Reserves are small business owners who risk losing their businesses. I strongly believe that some pre-deployment drill periods should include instruction from organizations like the Small Business Development Centers on how to plan for mobilization, and I look forward to hearing from our witnesses how such things can be put in place. Finally, GAO notes plans to improve TAP for the Guard and Reserves and that additional resources may be needed. Fortunately, the agencies here today represent most or all of the members of the TAP Steering Committee, which is chaired by the Department of Labor. I would appreciate if the Steering Committee would provide the subcommittee with a report within 60 days regarding the types of services and training you intend to provide, new partnerships required, if any, the timeline for implementation, and if additional resources are required, and how each department intends to meet that need. I know that our ranking member is very interested in this also, Ms. Herseth, and so whatever remarks you would care to make.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. Good afternoon to all of you, and thank you for being at the hearing today. I want to thank the chairman for holding today's hearing on such an important and timely subject. I thank the witnesses for being here today and look forward to your testimony. The Transition Assistance and Disabled Transition Assistance programs are very important tools in assisting our military service members adjust to civilian life and employment. I'm interested today in examining the witnesses' views on the overall effectiveness of the TAP and DTAP programs and how we can work together to promote and improve these services. Particularly, I'm concerned with how members of the Garden Reserve, many of whom come from rural areas, and how they fit into this transition process. And finally, with respect to the increasingly high number of wounded service members from Iraq and Afghanistan, the VA just yesterday admitted that the number of wounded is over 100,000. How is DTAP operating to assist in their rehabilitation, both physically and vocationally? Mr. Chairman, once again, thank you for your commitment to and bipartisan leadership on this important issue. I look forward to working with you, the agencies, and military service branches in implementing and improving transition services for our men and women in uniform. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead. They've informed us that the votes perhaps are going to be a while, so I say that. Now they're ringing the bell. That's probably jinxed us, but let's go ahead and get started. Let's have our first panel. Major General Ronald Young is the director of the National Guard Bureau Joint Staff. Mr. Craig Deering is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs. Ms. Judy Caden is Director of the VA's Vocational Rehab and Employment Service. And John McWilliam is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Operations and Management at the Veterans Employment Training Service. Let's begin with you, General.
Chairman Bozeman, distinguished members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you today about these very important programs. Transition Assistance Program and Disabled Transition Assistance Programs are critically important components of our efforts to take care of soldiers and their families. The information received during these briefings has long-lasting effects on our men and women in uniform, their families, and their communities. The effectiveness of TAP and DTAP also holds significant implications for the long-term health of our organizations as a whole. And specifically, I'm talking about retention and recruiting. As the recent GAO report noted, TAP and DTAP have not been completely effective. The recommendations included in this GAO report hold long-lasting and important implications for Guard soldiers and their families across the nation. The National Guard supports the initiatives planned or currently underway to improve the effectiveness of TAP and DTAP, as outlined in the GAO report. Changes in the presentation of TAP materials, the level of emphasis placed on briefings, and other initiatives noted in the report will put us on the road to success in this vital area. As noted in the GAO report, several pilot programs are underway that offer greater flexibility and creativity in the administration of these programs. The National Guard Bureau has taken the initiative to sign memorandums of understanding with several of the veteran service organizations around the country. We signed two such MOUs back in March with the VFW, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and also with AMVETS, the American Veterans. We're later in July going to be signing an MOU with the Disabled American Veterans. On May 18th of this year, Lieutenant General Blum, the Chief of the National Guard Bureau, entered a partnership and signed a memorandum of agreement with the Department of Veterans Affairs. That agreement between the two agencies established mutually agreed to requirements, expectations, and obligations as it in regards to the assistance and services that would be provided to our members. As part of that memorandum of agreement, the National Guard Bureau has put and is in the process of establishing state benefit advisors in all of the 54 states, territories, and the District of Columbia. Those state benefits advisors will be at the Joint Force headquarters in each state and will be able to track and provide assistance to the service members and their families and to provide assistance to the Adjutant General and other local agencies as we track our soldiers and make sure that they're getting the proper care and treatment. In addition to these programs, I believe that the service members should receive their Transition Assistance Program briefings and other materials at home station versus at the demobilization sites. As you know, and as the GOA report stipulated, the demobilization sites number about 27 across the country. And the fact that they are located at sites away from the home station where the spouse and the family members are located, there is a disadvantage there to the service member as they go through these briefings and try to make decisions that quite honestly, the family and the spouse and the soldier or the service member should be making together. New Hampshire is a model state for us, and they instituted a program that's called Reunion and Reentry Program. It was a program where they worked with the Department of the Army, were allowed to keep their soldiers coming back from the theater, over 800, on 5 days of additional active duty when they came back from the demob site. And they conducted a program broken into three groups, three blocks. They put soldiers in one block that dealt with administrative details, financial details, all those types of things to reintegrate them into the reserve component, back in the National Guard and back in the civilian community. The second day, a group spent at a VA hospital and actually went through a whole day of briefings with the family and the service member to explain all their benefits and entitlements of now being a veteran. And then the third day, they spent with the chaplains and received counseling such as suicide prevention, marriage enrichment, those types of programs to help them reintegrate. Now more than ever, taking care of our soldiers must be our highest priority. Leveraging the benefits available to National Guard soldiers and their families through enhanced administration of TAP is a key part of our commitment to the welfare of returning soldiers and their families. Working with the members of this committee, I believe the National Guard, along with DOD, Department of Labor, and Department of Veterans Affairs, as well as state and local agencies, can dramatically enhance soldier quality of life improvements for these important programs. Sir, transition assistance is a readiness issue. The way we take care of our soldiers and families today will be a direct reflection on how successful we are in the future to recruit the generations of soldiers and their families in the future. Thank you for this opportunity, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, sir. Mr. Deering.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Ranking Member, thank you for the opportunity to discuss the Transition Assistance Program, TAP, and the Disabled Transition Assistance Program with you today. Congress, in particular this subcommittee, deserves sincere thanks for its continued support of our efforts to ease the transition of our separating and retiring service members, as well as those being released from active duty from the Guard and Reserves. Let me begin by mentioning a couple of important points. First, TAP is one program consisting of four basic components. First, pre-separation counseling for which DOD has responsibility. Second, DOL TAP employment workshops for which DOL has responsibility. Third, VA benefits briefings for which VA has the responsibility. And fourth, finally, Disabled Transition Assistance Program for which VA also has the responsibility. Each agency is responsible for its component of the program, with DOD serving as the coordinating agency for conducting the program. The second point, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Reserve Affairs and I travel constantly throughout the country, conducting town hall meetings with service members, their families, and their employers. In the 4 years, he and I have yet to field the first question regarding TAP and DTAP. Because the vast majority of the Guard and Reserve service members return home to their former jobs, questions on the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act, USERRA, and the Service Members Civil Relief Act, SCRA, things like TRICARE and pay issues are at the forefront of most discussions. However, this is not to say that we don't need to acknowledge the areas of concern the GAO report raises. In the body of the prepared statement for the record, I've enumerated the many accomplishments of TAP as well as the plans for the near term to increase the viability of the program. The GAO report, serving as the basis for this hearing, it listed many of the changes underway and also pointed out areas that still require attention. From my review of the GAO report, I believe the real areas of concern for this subcommittee center on employment assistance, VA benefits briefings, and DTAP for the Guard and Reserve. In response to one of the GAO recommendations, the Department is taking the lead in collaborating with our partners from DOL and VA to form a demobilization working group, the focus of which will be to assess the needs of the Guard and Reserve members during demobilization. The program will make recommendations to all departments concerned on how we can improve transition assistance during the demobilization process for members of the Guard and Reserve. The group will work under the umbrella of our existing TAP Steering Committee, a standing committee with representatives from DOD, the military services, the reserve components, DOL, VA, and the Department of Homeland Security. The military services are already making every effort to provide pre-separation counseling to all returning units of the demobilization sites. The department will take the necessary steps to standardize the time allotted to TAP counselors so they can provide the quality pre-separation counseling briefings our Guard and Reserve personnel deserve. The department remains steadfast in its commitment to offer separating service members, retirees, Guard and Reserve personnel, and their families a quality transition assistance program well into the future. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, on behalf of our service members and their families, thank you, and the members of the subcommittee for your support during these demanding times. And could I add one personal note, that yesterday my wife and I were in the audience when you participated in the 2005 Congressional Flag and Independence Day celebration, salute to veterans in the military. And it was a marvelous program. We enjoyed what your role, and it occurred to us that none of those people were your constituents. You were there just because you really care about veterans, and it came through. So thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Thank you, and that really was a very nice tribute, you know, and a wonderful program, and I appreciate that. Ms. Caden?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to discuss the role of the Department of Veterans Affairs in the Transition Assistance Program and the Disabled Transition Assistance Program. My testimony will cover both of those programs generally and focus in particular on the issues and challenges of assuring that comprehensive VA benefits briefings are available to all members of the National Guard and Reserves who are called to active duty. I will also address the concerns and recommendations contained in the recent GAO report. As the subcommittee is well aware, TAP and DTAP programs are designed to prepare retiring or separating military personnel for their return to civilian life. DTAP is an integral component of the transition assistance for service members who may be released because of disability. In fiscal year 04, in total, including TAP and DTAP, VA representatives gave close to 8,000 briefings to active duty personnel in the U.S. and abroad, with nearly 277,000 in attendance. 4 hours of the TAP workshops are devoted to discussing VA benefits. And while some of these benefits and services are available for a lifetime, others are not. And we feel a profound sense of obligation to make certain that active duty service personnel are aware of any time limitations on applying for or using VA benefits. Although TAP and DTAP are central to our efforts to inform the men and women on active duty about VA benefits and services available to them, they're not the only vehicles through which we disseminate this information. In concert with the military services outreach programs, VA continued its benefits delivery at discharge, the BDD program, through which service members can apply for service-connected compensation within 180 days of release from active duty. Through that process, recently separated veterans can begin to accrue benefits toward their first disability check as soon as the month following their month of discharge. Currently, BDD is provided at 141 stateside locations and at 2 locations overseas in Germany and Korea. And in fiscal year 04, we took over 40,000 BDD claims, and we're keeping that pace and probably more for fiscal year 05. With the onset of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, we've expanded our efforts further through the Seamless Transition Program. VA representatives at key military treatment facilities, such as here at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, provide benefit information and coordinate the submission of claims to regional offices so that they can be processed more expeditiously. With the activation and deployment of large numbers of Reserve and National Guard, VA outreach to these members has been greatly expanded. National and local contacts have been made with Reserve and Guard officials to schedule briefings for those members being mobilized and demobilized. Last year, we conducted 1,400 pre- and post-deployment briefings, which were attended by close to 90,000 Reserve and Guard members, and we're expanding those numbers this fiscal year. We recently signed a memorandum of agreement with the National Guard Bureau, and under this agreement, the National Guard will establish opportunities for VA to provide information to Guard service members who are coming back. VA also published a brochure, a summary of VA benefits for National Guard and Reserve personnel, which is widely distributed to Guard and Reserve units. And despite these efforts, we know that much more needs to be done, particularly about because of changes if, when they're on active duty longer can change what they are eligible for. So let me now talk about the GAO report. As indicated in our comments included as Appendix 11 of the final report, we fully concur with the recommendations for executive action, particularly in working with DOD and DOL to explore logistical options for ensuring that members of the National Guard and Reserve have the knowledge to make the decisions they need to make. In particular, one is about the Montgomery GI Bill, whether or not to opt for that. And earlier this month, the TAP Steering Committee met to discuss ways to ensure members of the National Guard and Reserve are provided with such information in a timelier manner. And as you just heard, a work group is being formed that would all, from DOD, VA, DOL, and the National Guard and Reserve components to look at the best way of providing information in a timely manner. The GAO report also recommended that in order to develop more accurate program statistics, we should keep track of service members who attend TAP, DTAP, and other military briefings. We are putting into place a web-based reporting system that will respond to that recommendation, and we expect the system to be fully operational by October 1. Mr. Chairman, we at VA are proud of our continuing role in TAP and DTAP and seek to continually improve the quality and breadth of our outreach efforts. Thank you for allowing me to appear before today, and I look forward to responding to any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. McQuillian.
Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Hersat.
Can you stick your mic on?
Right on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The mission of our service is to provide transition service members and veterans with the resources and services to succeed in the 21st century workforce. One of the ways that we do that is by providing employment workshops to transitioning active guard and reserve service members. DOL works closely with our partner agencies, the Departments of Defense and Veterans Affairs, in providing TAP. Our goal at Department of Labor is to provide employment workshops at every location requested by the armed services. The DOL facilitated employment workshops are comprehensive 2 1/2-day sessions. Participants learn about job searches, career decision-making, current occupational and labor market conditions, resume and cover letter preparation, and interviewing techniques. Participants are also provided an evaluation of their employability relative to the job market. To maintain a high quality of service delivery and ensure uniformity between locations, all workshops use a common workbook and program of instruction. All facilitators are trained and certified by the National Veterans Training Institute. Mr. Chairman, we know that one of this committee's key interests is whether our National Guard and Reserve units are receiving the best transition services. These longer mobilization periods have resulted in these service members now being eligible for TAP. Our state directors are working directly with National Guard and Reserve component commanders to make special arrangements following demobilization to present a modified TAP employment workshop to Guard and Reserve service members. We have also contacted each state adjutant general to offer outreach and assistance to returning members of the Guard and Reserves. Thus far, Labor has provided TAP employment workshops to over 1,200 National Guard and Reserve component service members. We will provide any unit a workshop upon request. Recognizing that there is data showing a risk of homelessness amongst veterans, and in response to a congressional mandate to address the issue, Labor has developed a module on homelessness. This module will be added to the employment workshops after final coordination with DOD and VA. To promote better ties between the employment workshop and one-stop career centers, DOD and DOL are developing a supplemental guide to the employment workshop manual. This guide will provide detailed information about the one-stop career center services and how to access them. The Department of Labor fully supports the Government Accountability Office recommendation for a DOD-led effort to determine what demobilizing Reserve and National Guard members need to make a smooth transition. We are working through the TAP Steering Committee to fulfill this recommendation. Mr. Chairman, I would like to mention another effort that supplements our employment workshops. Secretary Chao initiated Real Lifelines, the Recovery and Employment Assistance Lifelines. This program provides a vital bridge in the transition of seriously wounded and injured service members, including Guard and Reserve. We currently have representatives stationed at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and Bethesda National Naval Medical Center. We will continue to expand this program and will soon be in place at additional military treatment facilities across the nation. We also have representatives at the recently established Military Severely Injured Joint Operations Support Center, and we're working very closely with the Department of Defense on that effort. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my testimony. I'm pleased to respond to any questions.
Thank you very much. I had the opportunity to go to Norfolk and visit the TAP Center there, and again, I just want to publicly state that we found that to be a very, very good program. I think I can speak for myself and the staff on both sides, you know, that was a very, very good trip. The materials were good. The quality of instruction was very, very good. So I think we were very impressed. Is that representative system-wide? How would you, I guess, you know, again, I think they do a good job. If we scaled them, you know, kind of up here, tell me our challenges. You know, is the rest of it, if that's a 10, I mean, is the rest of it, are we at fives or are we at threes? Or the other thing is certainly the fact that they, compared to some bases, you know, that they're, you know, so many people are transitioning out of there compared to maybe another area. Are we concentrating on the bases that we need to, where there is large turnover?
Mr. Chairman, from our viewpoint, the employment workshops are standard between TAP sites. So whether it's a very large TAP program at Norfolk or a very small TAP program at another location, they are very uniformly done. I think by having the large number at Norfolk, they're able perhaps sometimes to segregate the service members who come through and have a senior TAP for senior people and mid-grade people to address their issues more specifically. But I think it's a pretty uniform program no matter where you go.
I agree with the general. I think it is a readiness issue. And one of the things that we found in visiting with some of the people that were going through the program and had gone through it, in fact, we sat through part of the program where they were talking, you know, comparing the benefits outside, you know, what you needed to expect when you start paying for your own health insurance, you know, when you consider the fact that maybe you're making $40,000 there, but you've got $9,000 worth of health insurance and housing benefits and this and that. You could almost see, you know, a light go on in the room, you know, that the folks were getting it there. So one of the things that many people seem to feel like might be a good idea was making the TAP program mandatory, in the sense that there's somewhat of a stigma sometimes. If you sign up for the TAP program, then, you know, people feel like you're getting out, when sometimes you just want more information. I think if you did it early in some cases, then, you know, the person might not get out, you know, once they really understand, you know, what they're getting. The problem is, if you get it late, it's kind of like, you know, sending out the invitations to your wedding. You're married, you know, it's very difficult to back out at that time. What are your feelings about making it mandatory?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I believe right now the active duty Marine Corps is the only organization that has a mandatory briefing for others. And I think that we have sufficient authority already to do that if we wish. I think as part of our demobilization working group that we're forming, these are one of the issues we should look at, recognizing that there's a difference in requirements between the active duty and then the Guard and Reserve programs. As the GAO report pointed out in some of the other discussion that I've heard here, I think the requirements for the National Guard and Reserve, if I could dwell on them for a minute, would be different. On the one hand, they're going back to the communities they came from. Many cases, vast number of cases, they're going back to the jobs they left, and of course that's what USERRA is all about. We recognize that there are a significant number of people who may have been unemployed when they came in. And another factor we talked about yesterday was when you get back into the home environment, and of course this isn't going to take place until after you demob, the effect of the family, you know, the situation may have changed back there. And you may have to move or change your goals in life or what have you. Your whole family life could change. That may necessitate some sort of reentry back into the program. Now, what we've done to that end is it's really not a bad idea. I've got a couple of these cards here. This is the Army, and this is the Marine Corps card that every individual gets. And I'll read this. The Marine Corps One Transition Assistance Management Program. We're here to support you even after you've separated. And the contact information on both sides so that if they see a need, they can get back into the system. And then, of course, because of the timing, it may cross out of a DOD responsibility into the Department of Labor, which in many cases is better equipped at that point to assist them. I think that this demobilization working group that we've already started forming and we've already been discussing at the worker level is going to take these suggestions, these questions that you have, the suggestions in the GAO report, and the other suggestions that I've heard from both ends of the table here, and tie these together to put together, as you have said, a much better program to meet the needs of basically two different groups of people.
I think they are very different, you know, in that respect, and need to be tailored differently. I guess the people that we were, you know, being over there, you know, most of those people were mandatory regular, you know, regular service, and or not mandatory regular service. They were in the regular service. But one of the things of the mandatory, considering that, you know, the young enlisted guys or the young whatever, you know, getting in, if you had a program where halfway through their stay, you know, where they had to go and listen to it, then at that point, there's things that they could be doing at that point, educational-wise and everything else, to start preparing them to get out. From a recruiting, from a retention tool, I think some of them would realize that they had a pretty good deal. The career guys, you know, as they're transitioning out, you know, even at the halfway through their career or whatever, as you talk about these kind of things, you know, again, I think it's a retention tool in the sense of getting them to look forward to when they do get out, what do they need to do from an education standpoint when they're in the service and this and that. But personally, I think it's something that and again, you know, I don't get to, you know, to make the rules, but I do think it is something that needs to be looked at and that there would be a lot of positive. Also, if a guy could look at it, again, without the stigma of, you know, he gets the reputation, well, this guy's on the way out. You know, nobody wants that on their deal. Can you respond to that, or do you have any, either one of you?
Well, let me just jump on the active duty side for just a moment. I recall when I retired in 1996 and went through these briefings, we had some time to prepare. It was done before I left, whereas with the National Guard and Reserve, and I think General Young will talk about that, there's a different motivation, you know, to get home, and everybody is going through at exactly the same time. There's X number of days available, and I was transitioning, but I knew what I was going to do on the outside. So I needed a certain amount of information, but perhaps not the full-blown course. The services are probably in the best position to determine what their folks need. And again, it's been addressed in the GAO report, and we have said publicly that we are going to look at this. And I think that at this point, we have sufficient authority to make whatever changes are necessary if we feel that needs to be done. General?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there is two very different programs here that we need, quite honestly, for the Reserve and the Guard. The Reserve program needs to be a program that is conducted at home station with the family and with the spouse in attendance. The program at that point would be better received by the soldiers and the service members that are returning from the theater. I just finished a tour as the Assistant Adjutant General for Army in Ohio for 6 years, since 1999. I've mobilized over 7,000 soldiers and been to many of these demobilization sites. I've met every soldier coming home and been with them as they receive their initial briefings. Sir, they're not focused on these types of things at that point. Their spouse, their family is still back in Ohio. They want to get home. They want to get through the processing at the demob station as rapidly as possible. And even though they may be required to set in a briefing, it's not one-on-one, it's not individual counseling, and it's a group-type session. And their whole goal is to meet all the check marks in the blocks and leave the mob station to get home. The program I talked about earlier is a great program that's been conducted in New Hampshire. They're now in about their third phase. They came back in February and March. It's actually a continuum of care. They met them at the mob station, the leadership did, or the demob station. They brought them home. They talked to them again, and they did follow-up at the 30-day level, at the 60-day back from mobilization at their first drill. And they are continuing a program even out to 6 months at that point, just to ascertain where those service members are and what type of assistance they need. So I also think that there's an opportunity here while the service members are deployed in theater and focused on their wartime tasks to assist the families and talk to the families back in the family support groups and with the family assistance centers that we have established across the country. We have 416 family assistance centers in the Guard across the country. And by educating those individuals more thoroughly in all the benefits and entitlements, and attending the family support group meetings and making presentations to them about these benefits and entitlements, when the soldier gets home, that spouse or that family member is going to ensure at that point that they listen, pay attention, and enroll in the programs that are going to benefit that family for the rest of their life.
Thank you very much. I agree. We had 3,500 plus troops from Arkansas in Iraq, and I had the opportunity of seeing one of the groups return at Fort Hood. And, you know, you had individuals that literally, you know, had children, you know, that they'd never seen. And so I think what you're saying is accurate. You know, it's a very difficult time. You know, those families want to get reunited. They've got other things on their mind. And yet, on the other hand, as you said, from a readiness standpoint, you know, if you can get this done at some point, then I think you prevent divorce, you prevent financial problems and many things that as a VA and as a country, you know, come back and haunt us later. So, Ms. Herseth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe just to pick up a little bit on this line of questioning, and I appreciate General Young sharing information about what's worked in New Hampshire with the reunion and reentry program and the further description response to some of the chairman's questions about the phases and the importance of the continuum. We've talked in earlier hearings about the importance of the follow-up, particularly with National Guard and Reservists. And I would agree with the assessments that some of you have shared as well as the chairman that these transition assistance programs, as we target them to two different sets of individuals that are serving in our force, the active duty and, of course, now the heavier reliance on the National Guard and Reserve as we've made this transformation or in the stages of this transformation, certainly with recent deployments, that this goes to readiness and retention, but perhaps in different ways, perhaps with some of the enlisted members in active duty, if at the chairman's suggestion they receive some of this information earlier, they can better compare sort of opportunities within the military versus what might or might not be available in the private sector, or how they're going to make that transition at a different time, versus the importance of the retention for National Guard and Reserve, as you recommended, being connected with the family support groups during the deployment, having that level of trust, the working relationships, and the personal relationships with the spouses and other family members during the deployment and the follow-up. But let me, just so I, because I know in someone from our second panel may sort of question some of the timing of offering the transition assistance programs to the National Guard and Reserve for precisely the reasons that were described in terms of the motivation to get home, the separation from the family, what the expectations are. Now, you said that the first stage up in New Hampshire is an additional 5 days at the demobilization site. Is that correct? Of active duty at the demob site?
No, ma'am. The 5 extra days that the Army allowed them to stay on duty was back in New Hampshire.
Okay.
They had already left
with
the demo
families.
Station. I think it was Fort Dix. Yes, ma'am. They were welcomed home very informally by the leadership of the state, and the commander had the option to give them a day off with their family the first day.
Okay.
He could actually give them a pass. The second day they were brought in, they were broken down into 3 distinct groups. They all went to a different location. One group went to the VA hospital with their family, with their spouses, to hear the briefings again and to take advantage. And you know that some of the programs, ma'am, that they're entitled to require that they still be in an active duty status when they exercise that right or say that they want the program. So this just gives another 5 days. They're still in that refrad from active duty. So there's plenty of time to do this. And they can do it in a relaxed mm-hmm. atmosphere with their family, with local agencies that are aware of the employment opportunities, more specifically, you know, targeted to their area where they live.
And I know that General Michael Gorman, who is our state adjutant general in South Dakota, has been very involved, I think, working with his folks and with our state agencies and with the governor and his staff as our National Guard units have returned. But to the degree that you're aware, do the other adjutants general across the country have information about this particular program or other model programs that may be working in different parts of the country?
Yes, ma'am, they do. As a matter of fact, when we were at Omaha, Nebraska, with all the adjutant generals, I spoke to the Veteran Affairs partnership that we had just signed that day, and the chiefs of staff from each of the Joint Force headquarters was in Omaha with us, and I made a presentation to them with the details of both the partnership and the New Hampshire program, to holding it up as a model of something they might want to look at. As you know, each adjutant general can work his own programs. And most of our adjutant, I mean, this is not the only program we have going on in the country, but it is a model program. Washington, the state of Washington, has a great program also. But New Hampshire is one that we're holding up is one that has proven results. And the feedback that we're getting from the soldiers and the families is very positive.
And the focus on this program is a model program on the follow-up, the 30 days, 60 days, 6 months. I mean, I think with this group of individuals as part of our force, I think that's particularly significant that the follow-up be incorporated into any program that's being utilized.
Ma'am, I agree completely. Especially the mental health aspects that the VA is working with us and doing in this program.
Thank you. A couple of other questions, and the chairman's been kind enough to waive our 5 minutes here so we can probe a little bit further with you. Mr. During, thank you for bringing the memorandum of understanding to the attention of us and to staff today. And I may be asking a couple of questions with the second panel, too. And we appreciate, I know we were asked you about this before, and we appreciate that the memorandum of understanding has been signed. But just a couple of questions, and we can follow up with you after today's hearing, too. In terms of the sharing of the information and of the health data sharing, The MOU appears to be a good step in the right direction, and certainly with consideration of various privacy issues, I would like to know about the sharing of the individual health data and whether or not the VA, does this simply codify what currently exists and the VA has to wait for the discharge and the official transfer, or whether or not the VA has access to the individuals that may have suffered severe injuries and disabilities prior to the official discharge and transfer of the information over to the VA?
What I'd like to do is take that question for the record, if I could, okay. And we'll get you a good answer on that.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. Ms. Caden, given the number that's been provided to us here recently of those that have been injured seriously in Iraq and Afghanistan, exactly what services are provided within DTAP? You know, for example, does it cover federal employment preference, Americans with Disabilities Act protections, vocational rehab and employment programs, et cetera?
The DTAP program is very complete and very overarching, and it will cover all of that. It will talk about the USERRA rights, reemployment rights, if they're going to need to not go back to the job they were in, if they had a job before that, what we can do to help them from there, and what other benefits are available. It's we have the booklet that I brought up with me here last time. We've got a script that's now used, and we do show a video on the Voc Rehab program, so they get a lot of information on that.
I would just conclude by raising the same question or perhaps recommendation for further review of all of you as it relates to the mandatory status of the transition assistance programs, especially if indeed there has been some stigma attached over time for those who are participating or not. And also, Mr. McWilliam, just from your agency's perspective, as we've perhaps explored a little bit more than with the active duty, any concerns or thoughts or complaints, if that's what we call it, that you received as it relates to the assistance being provided on for the transition assistance for the National Guard and Reserve to focus particularly on this segment of our force?
Yes, ma'am. We have not received any complaints. We are prepared to provide employment workshops. I believe, as we mentioned in the prepared testimony, we are conducting three pilots with three different states looking at models of how to present the employment workshops. The one in Oregon was done very traditionally. We trained facilitators from the returning guard unit who assisted in giving the employment workshops. The one in Minnesota was done more on an individual basis, where the returning service members identify any issues they're having with employment, and then the workshop is geared towards the specific issues that they've raised. We're going to take all these ideas into the DOD-led working group so we can come up with the best practice to present nationwide.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Following up on Ms. Hurst's question about the New Hampshire experience, they had the five-day period. Did I understand right? Does the local general, does he have the flexibility to determine that period of time? Or
No, sir, he does not. What happened in that case was the adjutant general went to the first Army commander, Lieutenant General Honore, and asked for that authority to keep them on five extra days when they got home instead of putting them on their transition leave to use the leave that they had earned during their deployment. So he asked for a special privilege to do that, and First Army saw the benefits of the program and were agreeable to it. I am not aware of other states that have asked for that or been turned down. I have no one has told me that they've had any problem with that. So
he got a waiver then to do that. So
what's that, sir?
I said he got a waiver then to do that.
Yeah, sir. Yeah. And it wasn't so much as a waiver. The First Army commander has the authority to keep them on duty
right.
for whatever time after they get back that he would like to. And
sure.
5 days was a suitable period to accomplish this.
Yeah, very good. One of the things, you know, as we've talked among each other, and again, you all are bringing out, you know, the difference in the Guard experience and the regular military. In the Guard, you transition in as well as transitioning out. Many of these people are business owners and things that you know, there's just a real struggle, you know, that goes on in getting ready to go and getting things in wraps. You know, several of these people, we've all heard stories of people losing their businesses, you know, it being a tremendous financial strain. The National Association of Small Business Development Centers, you know, they've got 1,000 officers. That's your resource. Are we working with them to, I guess, what kind of resources are we, or are we using resources? Have we thought about the transitioning in? Again, I was very impressed with the transitioning out for regular. Going to, you know, and maybe we can go up and, you know, visit with the folks in New Hampshire, you know, about what they're doing transitioning out with the Guard. But what are we doing about them transitioning in, if anything?
Mr. Chairman, I can speak to just a little bit of that I'm fully aware of. Each one of our soldiers, as they prepare for deployment during the soldier readiness processing back at home station prior to leaving, interface with our employee support and Guard and Reserve, a representative in each state, an initiative that General Bowen put in place as soon as he was appointed to chief by putting that person out there in each state to help with employment issues and to help employers with issues of our Guardsmen. One of the programs that works through ESGR is a program called SCORE, Service Corps of Retired Executives. And they offer services to small business owners and some of our members to take advantage of to assist them with financial issues or how to run a business, how to keep it running while they're gone, those types of things. So both SCORE and the National Association of Small Business Development Centers are in tune with ESGR, and we have access to those programs through ESGR.
If a service member is deployed, say, you know, an individual is off and things do occur, does the person here, I mean, the wife or the husband of somebody in a small business, do they have the, is there somebody that they can access and get some counseling? Could the dependent that's left get the same thing?
Yes, sir. They certainly can. And, sir, I know exactly what you're talking about as far as some of our members that have lost some businesses. And it's a great hardship. There's no doubt about it. It's a great hardship. The soldiers and families that I've interfaced with understand the sacrifice and are willing to make the sacrifice. And many of them, in some cases, have actually volunteered for a second assignment and go and do it regardless of the impact on their business and on their family situation. But yes, sir, the person left behind to try to keep the business running does have access to these same types of assistances.
Very good. We've got some other questions that we'll submit. Ms. Herseth, have you got any? Thank you all very much. We really do appreciate you coming, appreciate your testimony. Again, the TAP program in Norfolk was excellent. If you can duplicate that every place, then, that is a huge success, that and the materials that you put together to give those individuals. We'd like to, I think, look, a little bit more at the reserve part of it, you know, and see what's going on there and see, you know, how it is differentiated and maybe can visit with the New Hampshire unit, you know, to see how that experience has worked and kind of go from there. So thank you all very much.
Sorry. Sure. Oh, is that mine?
That's yours, yeah.
Thank you. Do you want some? You got it?
Our second panel includes Ms. Cynthia Bassetta, Director of GAO's Veterans Health and Benefits Issues, Colonel Bob Norton, Co-Chairman of the Military Coalition's Veterans Committee, and finally, Mr. Brian Lawrence, Assistant National Legislative Director of the Disabled American Veterans. Ms. Bassetta, would you please get us started?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member Herseth. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify on our recently issued report on TAP, which was mandated in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2005. Entitled Enhanced Services Could Improve Transition Assistance for Reserves and National Guard, the report focuses on actions the Departments of Defense, Labor, and VA are taking and challenges they face in improving TAP. To do our work, we reviewed the legislative history of TAP, program materials, and participation statistics, and we conducted extensive interviews with officials from DOD, DOL, and VA. We also visited Fort Bragg, one of the heaviest volume demobilization locations, to observe TAP sessions firsthand and talk to participants, including Army Reserve and National Guard members. As you requested, my comments today highlight our concerns related to their transition assistance. Overall, we found variations in the delivery of TAP. The amount of personal attention, the length of components, and the instructional methods used all varied. For example, we found pre-separation counseling in one-on-one sessions of about an hour, group sessions at bases where many individuals were separating, and computer-assisted interactive programs at banks of computers so that service members could work at their own pace in other locations. At remote locations, TAP may be delivered by video or telephone due to the lack of trained personnel on site. Participation also varied. Not surprisingly, it was generally lower for the voluntary employment workshops, ranging from about 56 to 86%, and higher for mandatory pre-separation counseling. Notably, from fiscal year 2002 through 2004, Guard and Reserve members attending pre-separation briefings increased more than tenfold, from 9,000 to 93,000 members. During the same time, about 229,000 Army service members attended pre-separation counseling. Unfortunately, VA assumed that participation at workshops was a proxy for its benefit briefings and DTAP, so they didn't keep separate participation data. We recommended that they do so to develop accurate program statistics as well as to ensure adequate follow-up, particularly for disabled service members. Although several actions are underway or planned to improve TAP, we identified designing services that better meet the needs of Guard and Reserve members as a particularly important challenge. For example, typically, as you've heard, the demobilization is completed in 5 days or less. And more importantly, as we've also discussed today, Guard members want to get back to their families as quickly as possible. As a result, unless TAP is redesigned, they risk not receiving timely information on benefits to which they are entitled, especially education benefits and medical coverage that require service members to apply while they are still on active duty. Their opportunity to participate in the 2 to 2.5 day employment workshops is also severely curtailed by the rapid demobilization timeframe. To deal with these logistical challenges, the departments told us that they're considering the option of offering some TAP components after demobilization. They could present their briefings during scheduled drill weekends, and DOL could conduct workshops as well after demobilization. They told us that they were unsure about how many Reserve and Guard members might be interested in this option, and they believe that this would also require additional resources and a directive that commanders allow sufficient time for transition assistance. One promising source of information on these issues is the 3-state pilot programs in which DOL is involved to better understand how post-demobilization workshops might work. To ensure the outcome is fully explored, we recommended that DOD, in conjunction with its VA and DOL partners, determine what National Guard and Reserve members need to make a smooth transition, and that they explore the logistical options for providing that assistance. Other positive steps they've taken include eliminating the one-size-fits-all approach by updating counseling checklists, considering expansion of mandatory components of TAP to increase participation, and developing multiple outreach strategies to better disseminate information. Mr. Chairman, our wartime reliance on the National Guard and Reserves has focused our attention on ways to help all returning service members. Surely these men and women who put their lives on the line every day deserve the smoothest transition back to civilian life that we can offer. And we encourage DOD, DOL, and VA to continue to vigilantly pursue ways to improve TAP. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Thank you very much. Colonel Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ranking Member Herseth. I am honored to present testimony today on behalf of the 35 members of the Military Coalition, which collectively represents approximately 5.5 million members of the uniformed services community, active duty, National Guard and Reserve, family members, retirees, veterans, and survivors. Mr. Chairman, you asked for the Coalition's views on the overall TAP-DTAP programs and specifically issues addressed in the GAO report. I will focus my remarks on three issues and concerns from my prepared statement. First, TAP and DTAP funding is inadequate to meet the needs of all service members who are separating from active duty, including members of the Guard and Reserve. The GAO report states that TAP funding requirements are based entirely on projected active duty separations. The services have separated an average of 200,000 active duty troops per year, and TAP budgets were built on those projections alone. But since 9/11, almost 500,000 members of the Guard and Reserve have been called up. Last year alone, 117,000 reserve troops were demobilized, but no additional funds have been earmarked by the VA, DOD, or the Department of Labor for TAP or DTAP activities for them. Taking an average of about 100,000 Guard and Reserve separations per year, the TAP budgets should be increased by about 50% over current spending levels. Second, the Military Coalition agrees with the GAO that the TAP-DTAP program should be adapted to meet the needs of Guard and Reserve troops separating from active duty. But the last thing most citizen soldiers need is a mandatory week of TAP outbriefings after they return from deployment. For one thing, as has been pointed out already, their spouses and families are not available in most cases to participate in TAP activities. Active duty troops are assigned to installations. Reserve troops are not under the installation commander's control, and they pass through the demobilization sites normally without their family members. But also, TAP information needs to be tailored to their specific needs. The Coalition supports initiatives like the state-based pilot employment workshops. We also believe that the veterans benefits component of TAP needs to be expanded for reserve troops and delivered back in the community wherever possible. Many Guard and Reserve troops would benefit by information on enrollment in VA health care, filing claims for disability, reemployment rights, economic and financial rights and protections under the Service Members Civil Relief Act, Small Business Administration disaster type loans, GI Bill education benefits, and other valuable VA program information. Thirdly, we agree with the GAO that there appears to be some progress in developing TAP and DTAP checklists that address the unique needs of the Guard and Reserve service members and their families. My prepared statement offers specific observations for further improving those checklists. The Coalition wants to emphasize, however, that more needs to be done to advise and assist returning Guard and Reserve veterans and their families, especially those with physical disabilities and mental health disabilities. And we recommend that the Congress impose a reporting requirement on the departments of DOD, VA, and Labor to report back to the committee and the subcommittee on measures taken to improve the coordinated delivery of TAP services. It was mentioned earlier, Mr. Chairman, that a demobilization work group has been developed, and we applaud that, but we think that there ought to be the greatest amount of transparency possible in terms of the work and the recommendations and the outcomes of the demobilization work group, so that all of us in the stakeholder community can see and assess what progress has been made in terms of improving TAP and DTAP services for the Guard and Reserve, especially, but for all of the separating troops as well. A number of coalition organizations, including my own, the Military Officers Association, are actively engaged in providing outreach and support assistance to disabled veterans in the community. The DAV, the VFW, many VSOs also have robust programs. We are proud of that work, but recognize its inherent limitations. Congress needs to provide additional funding for government-sponsored services provided by the VA and the Department of Labor in the community, not only for the physically disabled, but for those wounded in mind and heart as a result of their service. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I would just also mention that from my prepared statement, the Military Coalition strongly supports accelerated development of what we call seamless transition initiatives. We have testified on this before, not only before this committee, but also before the Armed Services Committee. We recommend a Manhattan-like project to accelerate the development of an electronic DD-214, the separation document, a one-stop separation physical. As has been pointed out, their BDD, benefits delivery at discharge, has been expanded, and we recommend further expansion of that program, and the development of electronic medical records, which has been mentioned earlier, so that information can be quickly and seamlessly reported from the DOD over into VA. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement, and I thank you again for the opportunity on behalf of the Military Coalition to testify before your subcommittee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel. Mr. Lawrence.
Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Herseth, on behalf of the disabled American veterans, thank you for the opportunity to present our views on the Transition Assistance Program and the Disabled Transition Assistance Program. I'm grateful for the opportunity to supplement my written statement, because in further discussions with some of our transition assistance officers, some simple suggestions were made that could increase the efficiency of the process. The first is that DD-214s, the discharge documents, should automatically be provided to the VA by DOD, as Colonel Norton said, preferably by electronic transfer. Currently, an individual must wait to acquire his or her DD-214 from Department of Defense after discharge and then deliver it to the VA. Since almost every transitioning member is also relocating to another geographical area, it would be helpful if the transfer was automatic. In addition to alleviating service members' frustration, it would help the VA maximize its efficiency. Secondly, the pre- and post military deployment health questionnaires should also be included in service medical records, which are the primary evidence considered when VA determines entitlement to service connection. I was surprised to learn that in most cases, deployment health questionnaires are maintained by DOD for its exclusive purposes. DOD understandably requires such information for health studies, but that requirement should not preclude VA's access to the questionnaires, because they hold important information regarding benefits entitlement. Copies of deployment health surveys should automatically be included in service medical records. Lastly, in talking with our transition folks, the most emphasized suggestion I received was that the benefits delivery at discharge, or BDD, sites should be expanded to include all discharge facilities. BDD is a cooperative effort between DOD and VA to provide a physical examination that satisfies both agencies' purposes. Previous procedures required two separate examinations conducted several months apart. The first was a DOD exam, followed by a secondary VA exam for compensation claims. BDD improves service for separating service members by eliminating lengthy delays in claims decisions, avoids redundant and unnecessary exams, and improves the quality of the exams. BDD takes the pressure off overly burdened VA regional offices that already face backlog problems, and veterans receive disability ratings sooner after discharge, and the accuracy and satisfaction with those ratings is generally of higher quality or more readily agreed with. The DAV strongly recommends that BDD be made available to every person retiring or separating from active duty. And that concludes my statements. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. You mentioned, Ms. Bassetta, about there being different, varied methods of delivery, throughout the system. Was that just a comment or is that a criticism? I mean, there's different ways to get things done, depending on if you've got a group where you've got 10,000 separations versus, a much smaller amount.
Right. That's correct. We believe that the flexibility that we saw is not a bad thing. They're dealing with different volumes of people on different days and a different mix of separating service members. So it's not necessarily indicative of a problem that there's variation, as long as the content that's delivered is the same and as long as there's adequate attention paid to the most important pieces of information that the service members need, for example, those that are time sensitive in that they need to apply for them, the education benefits and the TRICARE, while they're still on active duty.
One of the themes that we, as we visited with individuals that were taking the course and others that, had taken it, whether we visited individually as a group, was that many of them said that, if they just known, that they were entitled to all this stuff, that it would have made a difference, as they, while they were in the service, that literally the only time they heard of it was when they were recruited. And as a young, as a young recruit or whatever, you just didn't, you didn't have the understanding of what went on.
If I might add, at Fort Bragg, we were there in February, and I'm glad to hear that the Norfolk experience was a very positive one for you. We were impressed also at Fort Bragg, but we noticed also that the amount of information was simply overwhelming. And, for that reason, there definitely needs to be follow-up. But and we understand that departments are working very hard to try to get information in ways that's more accessible to the service members, ways that, not paper like this, but laminated cards that they can put in their pockets and that they won't lose, 800 numbers, things like that that can improve their ability to reach back out if they've forgotten something. But, in some of the sessions that we were at, the talking was pretty rapid. Some of the critical information was on a table, and if, you came in one door, you might not necessarily have picked it up. So those are the kinds of issues that we're concerned about.
Well, I think that goes to, the thought now is that there might be a, some sort of a tendency to go to a two-day program versus a four-day, if we're having problems with the extended period, then, certainly a two-day program would only heighten that greatly. So I agree with you totally. How about, do you have any, not knowing the benefits and this and that, do you have any ideas about mandatory as part of just their, as they go through their career, periodically having to take some sort of thing like this to, again, so that halfway through their career, they can start positioning themselves educationally in every other way as they get out, or maybe that they realize that as they do these things, that they're better off staying in for another tour?
We didn't ask that question for this report, but we testified in 2002 on this issue, and that came up. And, in fact, the way it came up, if I recall, is that some of the commanders who were reluctant to give the time to their service members for the benefit became believers, if you will, when their service members came back and said that they didn't want to leave the military because they actually felt that their options in the military were better than outside. The other comments I'd make with regard to mandatory are that We definitely think that the VA briefings should be mandatory. There's too much important information there that now tacked on to the end of an employment workshop, which some service members may not go to, will be missed. Of course, they should be getting the TRICARE notification at the precept counseling, which is already mandatory. And with regard to the workshops, I don't think that we would recommend that they be mandated, because there probably are a group of people, I don't know how large that group is, who don't need that workshop. But if a service member elects to attend the workshop, then what they should definitely be considering is a mandatory release.
Thank you. Colonel Norton, Mr. Lawrence, especially you, Colonel Norton, you alluded to the fact that, you know, that the guard units, you know, coming back, you know, didn't want to be held an extra 5 days or whatever. And yet, you know, also alluded to the fact that there's so much information that they need, you know, including, you know, their health, you know, understanding, you know, that they needed to be reporting their health care, their VA benefits, and the, again, 4 days worth of stuff, you know, goes on and on. What is your all's recommendation? I mean, I understand that totally. Like I said, I was at a ceremony where, again, you know, people were looking for children that they'd never seen, and you know, this separation, this boots on the ground for a year, you know, is a tough deal.
Right.
What's the answer? I mean, you know, how do you get that information conveyed to them and their families without doing something, you know, along that line?
It's a great question, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it's so much a question of mandatory versus optional as what is the optimal moment, I'll call it the teachable moment, if you will, where deactivating members of the Reserve and Guard are ready to understand and receive that information. And so, as General Young and others have pointed out earlier, back in home station is a much more conducive learning environment to begin to assimilate this mountain of information. And in addition, because the family members are back home, often decisions about health care, decisions about how to restore and rebalance family finances, reemployment issues, service members, Civil Relief Act protections, all of those kinds of things automatically, in a sense, kick in when you're returned to the community. Mm-hmm. So the idea of having follow-on information briefings by the VA in, for example, the Community Readiness Center, the Family Readiness Work Groups, makes a lot of sense to us. I would add as well that we applaud the idea of this MOU between the National Guard and the VA. However, as with the Joint Services Disabled Support Center, which was recently stood up by the Department of Defense to basically oversee policy and coordinate the transition of disabled servicemen and women, I think more needs to be done by the Defense Department as sort of the lead dog, the lead agent in this, to coordinate overall the delivery of this information and service to all of the reserve components, not just the National Guard. At the end of the day, there are large numbers of Army Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve, and other Federal Reserve troops that have been called up. And if the services that are being set up between the Guard and the VA are essentially for them alone, it's going to be dysfunctional for the entire team. So that's why one of the reasons why we'd like to see a little more transparency in the planning and the coordination process at the DOD level in terms of moving the whole team forward on this issue of delivering services in the local community.
I agree, and I sometimes misstate in the sense I have a tendency to lump the Guard, meaning the Reserve, you know, components together in the sense that they do have special needs. So GAO, you all basically said that, if I understand, that this should be done during the drill period?
We thought that was definitely an option worth considering, yes.
And that's really what you're saying, Colonel Norton, is that...
Yes, I don't know whether it was mandated.
At home, you know, at the...
some mechanism to deliver it in the home station. Family support groups, work groups, is probably as good a place as any. If they're As General Young indicated, there are over 400 of these, and that probably could serve the entire Reserve and National Guard community, if the coordination was properly structured.
I think Colonel Norton's exactly right. I'd just add that the same requirement about the commanders needing to allow time would be very important to ensure that anybody who opted for the workshop would be able to actually attend.
Ms. Herseth.
Thank you. You mentioned, Ms. Becerra, that you saw down at Fort Bragg an increase from 9,000 to 90,000 participants?
That's total.
Total.
Yes.
And Colonel Norton, you had mentioned what I think is a very important component here is the funding associated with providing these services at an adequate level. Of course, redesigning the program to meet the needs of National Guard, Reserve, active duty components of the force. And we take that to heart, given some of what we're facing on the healthcare front, that it's an important part that we're using not just active duty separation projections, but what's happening with the National Guard and Reserve in the modeling to project what the needs are going to be as we look to changes to make these transition assistance programs as effective as possible. So I just couple of thoughts. I won't pose any questions other than to ask Mr. Lawrence, you provided some information on the memorandum of understanding and some concerns. Despite the fact that it's been signed between DOD and the VA, we have to address some of the ongoing concerns that perhaps GAO has as well. So if you could take the same question for the record that I posed to Mr. Deering to address whether it's some of the electronic transfer of information, individual or access by the VA to individual health data prior to discharge, prior to transfer, if you could submit that to us and our staff as well to share your assessment and evaluation and concerns you have about that MOU in addition to what you've already testified to, Mr. Lawrence, and what I know the GAO may be focused on in that memorandum. But the last thing I would offer, and I know Mr. McWilliam is still here, and going on some of what the chairman shared in his experience with some of the folks in Arkansas and what I've seen in South Dakota, especially with the National Guard, and what I would propose is just a factor to keep in mind when you're looking at redesigning the transition assistance programs and the importance of the follow-up for the National Guard and Reserve. I think it's a very good idea to have the spouses and family members during the deployments involved understanding what the benefits are. But we also are very well aware of the fact that that transition back within the family life poses some challenges as well. And we know that these units are very cohesive during these deployments. And I put out just as an idea based on some of the conversations I've had, including with former students of mine from a couple of years ago that have served in these deployments, try to identify within the National Guard units a couple or handful of people that can become the in-house experts, the members themselves that have returned, that are on the phone with their fellow servicemen and women from that Guard unit, that are meeting up with them on a more informal, casual basis, that can share this information outside of a formal type, an official setting during the drills, 30 days after, 60 days after. All of that is important. But I do think that we should try to identify some folks within the unit itself that become the in-house experts for the unit, not just the commanders, not just the leadership, but some folks that have identified an interest in or are already taking advantage of some of those benefits that can share that information with people that they consider their second family after these deployments. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Herseth. Again, I want to thank the panel. I equate this. I'm an optometrist and eye doctor, so I equate a lot of things to healthcare. But this, you know, if you scored it somehow dynamically, it's kind of like if you don't take your high blood pressure medicine, or if you're diabetic, you know, and you don't take your medicine for that. You know, you don't hurt, you know, and this and that. Everything goes along. And then in the case of the high blood pressure, you know, you have a stroke, and then that stroke cost a lot more money to deal with than taking a very inexpensive pill. And I think the problems that are encountered if this isn't done right, you know, either in, you know, the TAP program or in the program that you know, in the case of the individuals that all of a sudden are thrust into the military from civilian life without, you know, getting their things in order, truly a lot of the problems that we deal with in the VA later on are as a result of failure that's caused from this. And so I personally think it's money well spent. We really need to, you know, as Ms. Herseth alluded to, and Colonel Norton brought it up, you know, we need to look and make sure that we are adequately funding the program. Certainly the demands and the needs now are different than they were before 9/11. And then again, go from there. So once again, thank you very, very much for your testimony. Have you got anything else? Okay. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.